Well,
it doesn't happen here.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. We're going to do a little business stuff first before we get to House Bill 3606, but it won't be too long. Let me make a few announcements. Let's start with House Bill 3667. I had asked the Advantage Dental folks and the OEA folks to get together and work on an amendment they can both live with. I've heard we're very close to that, so my hope is we will get that by Wednesday. I'm going to carry over House Bill 3667 to Wednesday and try and work closely with you all, Legislative Council and the LFO and revenue, to make sure we have everything ready, and we hope we'll move it on Wednesday. Does that have a subsequent to Ways and Means? 3667.
Not at this time.
Okay, and does not have a subsequent, and the hope is it won't have one. And if it doesn't, then we'll be able to move. I'm going to also carry over House Bill 3639 to Wednesday. We'll see how that's going between now and Wednesday. And we're going to carry over House Bill 3662 to Wednesday. The word is we are expecting the Senate to move a version of that bill tomorrow. And if so, we'll let it rest here. Let's see what else we have to do. Hold on a minute. Representative Nathanson, where are we on House Bill 3642?
I think we're ready to take action.
Okay.
I'm going to ask the committee administrator to confirm that.
Correct.
Okay, and I'll open up a work session on House Bill 3642. Representative Nathanson, do you have an amendment to that, or are we all set?
Yes, I think we're all set. The committee approved two amendments at a previous meeting.
Could you fill us in where we are, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Nathanson is correct. At the February 3rd meeting, when we had the public hearing and a small work session on this bill, the committee adopted the dash 1 and the dash 3s. What you have before you are those combined amendments to the dash 4. We do have a fiscal impact on those dash 4s, as well as a revenue impact statement with no revenue, but we do have a fiscal statement, Mr. Chair.
Do we need to adopt the dash 4s?
No, we don't, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and they've asked us to put a subsequent, is this the one they've asked us to put a subsequent to Ways and Means?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I didn't know if Representative Nathanson wanted to just speak to that briefly. Or
Representative Nathanson, will you comment on that, please?
As I understand it, even though we will be licensing the same number of physician assistants and physicians as we're licensing now, this is a new kind of responsibility, a new kind of structure for the board to manage, and they believe that it will be a little bit of additional, I'll call it paperwork, it's probably electronic data that we're talking about, some additional data entry responsibility for them that they believe they have incurred. It's also my understanding, I just now saw it, I haven't read it, but it was my understanding that the board felt that they had funds sufficient to cover the costs of that.
So you're comfortable even though it needs to go there, it will make its way out of there?
Let's see. I hope that is the case. I sincerely do.
Okay. Well, how about a motion which includes Representative Harker, you have one?
I have one. Hopefully it will include what you want. Chair Greenlink, I move House Bill 3642 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
We have a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion?
Briefly, Mr. Chair. Representative,
Did the medical board provide you in writing the, I'm interested by the fiscal. Maybe we can talk about it offline, but.
I did not myself receive any information that this was going to require additional staffing. I will admit to you, I was somewhat surprised. I've given you the rationale that I have heard that the board has provided to Legislative Fiscal Office. I have not received that myself. As I was looking at it, it's the same number of licensees, slightly different system. It had not been brought to my attention that this would require additional staffing.
Sandy, will you review what it says in the fiscal statement?
Yeah, I will be reading it after the meeting.
Oh, Mr. Chair, do you want me to read the whole thing or just?
Well, the bottom line.
Well, bottom line, House Bill 3642, the medical board is anticipating a slight increase in workload, therefore asking for what now is an uncertain FTE. It might be a quarter FTE, it might be a half or a full, they're not sure. Anytime anybody is asking for additional staff, it does generate a fiscal impact. That's in the analysis of the fiscal impact statement. Also, it's coming from in the statement is if the impact is clearly Zoom care, it will be a minimal impact. What's unknown is how many other organizations might take advantage of that, thus varying the workload to the medical board, and so that's an unknown that is also reflected in the fiscal impact.
Did they put a number on that?
They did. But it is all other funds, Mr. Chair. They've broken it down into personnel services and then supplies.
How much of a number did they put? What's the number?
170?
No, 74,756.
Other funds.
In this
in other funds. On the dash fours. For this biennium, 09 to 11. 11 to 13, it's $100,844.
Representative Kotek, I don't see any option but to send it to you.
Well, I look forward to this conversation Ways and Means, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
So let's send it there where you and Representative Nathanson have direct representation of that.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
I can add one other thing. There's what I think is a key sentence in the LFO analysis. In about the middle of the page, the first sentence of the middle paragraph there says, OMB is at capacity with its existing workload. It could be that by this time next year, they would have needed an additional 0.25 anyway. It sounds like they've been operating at capacity for at least a little while, and this is a trigger, perhaps, for them to say, well, it's about time we ask for additional capacity.
To put it in diplomatic terms and to be as sensitive as possible, I think it's nuts. But let's pass it on, and you guys can fight it out in Ways and Means. Ready for a vote? Debbie, can we have a roll call, please?
Where do these fiscals come from?
Representative
Brown?
Aye. Wait a minute. Is that motion with a due pass recommendation?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Referred to Committee on Ways and Means.
Go ahead.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on, where are we? On 3642 and open a work session on 3666. That was lacking a fiscal and revenue last time. Do we have a pass on it now, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do. We were lacking the proper paperwork on the Dash 1 amendments, which I'd like to remind the committee. The committee did adopt the Dash 1 amendments at the February 4th meeting. And if the committee chooses to take action, we're ready to go.
Can I have a motion?
Just a due pass.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, what is this, 3666?
Right. We adopt them.
Yeah, 3666, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on the motion? A roll call, please.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Hoyle.
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer.
Aye.
Representative Clifton.
Aye.
Representative Nathanson.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mauer.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Motion carries. We don't have consent calendar, right? Have we confirmed that? Okay. Somebody like to carry this? Volunteer? All right, who's the newest member of the committee?
I was going to bail her out, but go ahead. I think that sounds great. That sounds excellent.
I do believe that's Representative Nathanson. The committee after me.
Okay. Representative Nathanson, you got it.
That's scary.
Carried by Nathanson. I just thought it would be a good of you to start with because it's so easy.
I was trying to follow the rules.
What they say about payback, don't you say?
Yeah. Tina, you want to talk about the...
Good. Very good. Glad to answer.
Close the work session on 3666. Open a work session on 3664 for a comment at least. Representative Kotek, can you tell us where we are on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, you have a Dash 2 amendment in front of you and, oh, you're great, Sandy, a hand-engrossed version of the Dash 2s. If you recall, last time we talked about this is the bill that would allow medical assistance to continue for use aging out of foster care up to the age of 21. And we've been talking with the Department of additional ways to figure out a fiscal on this. So the Dash 2s would do what I mentioned the other day in committee to include what are essentially our children under the state. We are their parents. They're aging out of foster care. They would be covered under the Healthy Kids program, and the funding element would be the same funding for Healthy Kids, which is the 1% premium tax that we currently use as the revenue to fund that program. And that's what the Dash 2s do. We would have to get a fiscal within our next meeting, but that's what I would like us to adopt and move if the committee so chooses.
Adopt the Dash 2s.
Question.
Go ahead.
To Representative Kotek, if I may. Once again, you're saying this is no new revenue past the tax increase that was passed last session. Did I hear that correctly? to cover these foster care kids, 8 to 21, it would come from that 1% tax.
Correct. And I believe we had the fiscal for the bill as it was written, and right. It talks about, we're talking probably about, I think it's a little unclear, but could be up to 400 adults in that age range that would be. And I don't know if DHS is here to answer some of those questions.
Join us?
Judy's here, yeah. Judy's been working with
us. Judy was hiding in the back there.
And Mr. Chair, a follow-up. Yeah, thanks.
You want to follow up?
Well, the question, and Representative, I'm not sure if you can answer that or maybe somebody else is better able to. If this is coming in, if this is new service in addition to those services that were planned with that tax last session, what are we not doing in those prior services that we're now going to do if we pass this? Once again, I don't know if we have a clear answer to that.
Well, you are correct that we'd be adding a few more individuals to the coverage through the funding source, not necessarily right. Healthy Kids, but the funding source. But I don't know if Judy wants to comment on
no,
that.
No, I'm trying
to,
it's what are we giving up to get this, I guess, is the
if
question.
Anything, right.
So for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Assistant Director for DHS in charge of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And if I understand your question, it's if we use the insurance tax, what would we not be doing under the Healthy Kids? And as of right now, while we do have the estimates, we don't have the final enrollment numbers for the Healthy Kids, et cetera. And so if our enrollment was higher than what we had anticipated for Healthy Kids, then we would need to meet with you all and internally to figure out how those would get funded. And we would need to work through if the revenue estimates weren't as high or were lower, any of those circumstances. So at this point, we're not really able to say what specifically wouldn't happen because it's kind of early on in the process.
We're going to hear about more where you are in a little bit. in reference to...
Right. Well, and I think this, some of these questions will be more clear once we see the fiscal, but I also would point out the advantage of doing this funding mechanism, if we want to cover this population, is we can use a higher match rate, potentially, for some of them.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, actually, we would still use the Medicaid match rate.
Okay.
The CHIP match rate, these children do not qualify under CHIP, okay. So it would be the regular Title 19 match rate, which is the standard. It's not the so-called enhanced rate of the CHIP.
Which is allowed through the Chaffee waiver, which allows us to cover that
correct.
Population. Okay. And just to clarify, it's only 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, because the Chaffee waiver, which is a match, allows us to match, would not include once you reach the age of 21, which is the federal standard is adult. So it would just be those 3 years.
But
go ahead.
I mean, but that's what we were asking for, is up to that 21st birthday.
Correct. Right. I think there was some misunderstanding that we also would include 21, once you were 21, yeah. But right. No, that's...
Okay.
Unless we wanted to, we would not get matched past that 21st.
18 is not included now?
Well, what happens is once you reach 18 in the foster care system, you no longer continue your health coverage. Even though under Healthy Kids, we cover
okay.
people at 18.
So it is 3 years. It's just the 18, yeah. 19.
Right.
Right.
I've been saying it wrong, too.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up here. I just want to make sure that we're able to make good on the promise that we made to kids in the last session. Kids... up to 18, and perhaps it'd be helpful to see the fiscal, be helpful to hear about where Healthy Kids is in terms of enrollment, but what I think I heard you say was that if, as a result of the passage of this bill, we end up with a few more kids enrolled in Healthy, young people enrolled in Healthy Kids than we anticipated, you might have to come back to the legislature. That's not the position I think we want to be in mid-biennium. So...
Well, if remind folks, the fiscal that we did on Healthy Kids was based on 90% enrollment. I'm looking at the, I mean, it was an estimate, as all things are. Clearly, we want to reach our targets, but I think that remains to be seen. I would also add that philosophically, as my parents covered me when I went off to college, these are still our children in the sense that they are aging out of the foster care system, and we are providing that transitional. I think there is a philosophical consistency with what we were trying to do with Healthy Kids. I understand that it's a slight blip in terms of a few more people what we would be required to cover, but this seems adequately aligned in terms of how we fund it.
Just a follow-up. I just want to ensure that we're not in a position where we have to say no to an otherwise qualified Healthy Kids enrollee qualified under our 2009 action because we don't have the funds to enroll it.
I think that's what Representative yeah. Boone was.
Bruin.
Bruin. Boone is that. I know
that other lady.
Yeah, I got that. Bruin was asking that question, yeah. I think. Okay, so.
But and just to remind folks, the general fund fiscal, if we were to do this in this source through the, it's about $500,000.
Correct.
There are, you know, the roll-up, obviously, for 11-13 is higher, which might be what you're worried about. I'm not worried about for this by any means, but I also believe we don't know what the overall enrollment is going to be.
Well, let me ask about that. I mean, it seems to me if we're saying this fits into the basic concept of Healthy Kids, and there is a budget for Healthy Kids, and we haven't heard that they're oversubscribed yet, then there should be no general fund. Impact, is that right? I mean, it's only if this oversubscribes, mm-hmm. as I think Representative Bruin was asking about, if it oversubscribes, we need to come back and ask for more money. There'll be a general fund, but we don't have any indication that there is not.
I don't know. Does Dr. Goldberg want to maybe comment as well? He seems animated, so we can
trying to stay in his seat.
Keep him awake for the afternoon. It's good.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Department of Human Services. And I think the question that's coming up is that we're working within a budget box for the Healthy Kids program, and we neither know exactly how much revenue is going to come in through the premium tax, nor do we know exactly how many kids are going to enroll. We will discover these as we move forward over the biennium. We believe we have sufficient funds to cover all the kids that we need. But again, we also have some mechanisms by which we can manage that enrollment. I would say that given the number of children that are being proposed by this bill, if I understand it correctly, it's what I would say within the margin of error of our ability to predict. You know, we've estimated and we've budgeted for the fact that we hope we can get 80,000 kids by the end of the biennium. This is approximately 400 children, I believe, and so it really is, like I said, it's within the what is the margin of error of the fiscal impact for the original Healthy Kids plan, knowing that we cannot. I can't sit here today and tell you exactly how many kids are going to enroll, nor can I tell you exactly the amount of dollars that will come in from the premium tax, because that's going to be variable as well based on the degree to which health insurance premiums either go up, go down, et cetera.
But I also think we do know is that this particular population, I mean, having looked at this population for several years now, this is a relatively static population in terms of the number of young adults we're talking about. So if you're worried about a rising caseload there, I just don't see that happening on the horizon. This is very static. It's 3 years.
Yes, sir. I got a couple questions. The full cost option under Healthy Kids Connect is how much? Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer. Representative Maurer, you're talking about for kids above 300% of poverty?
Correct.
It's approximately 200 and between $200 and $280 a month, depending on the plan.
Okay.
And there's no match attached to that?
Correct.
No match. And the fiscal that we had for this foster care population translated to $465 a month. So now
general
you...
General
fund. Or it was matched. But regardless, the fiscal was a whole lot more per kid than the full cost plan. So that means your experience is going to go up. I mean, I'm assuming that's where that difference is. Because that's going to mean fewer kids can be covered because we're paying more for this population. Am I not correct, or what?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, the expense of those 400 kids in terms
of... I think it's 500. That's the number we had.
I don't remember what that
is. I use the term 400 because that's...
Okay.
That subset of children have very a lot of high need.
Okay.
And so when figured themselves as a group of 400 or 500, their per member per month costs are clearly higher than a group of 80,000 children blended across all those 80,000 children.
Okay. When you put those 400 into 40,000 kids, it's completely the minimis, the effect it'll have on
it. It will have an effect. We can figure out what that might be, but my sense would be that it would be minimal, given that that risk would be spread over 80,000 children.
Right. And I accept that. How many kids do we have signed up today in the
We're going to get a full report in the hearing that we have. Yeah, in the hearing that we have. That's Representative Wyden.
Oh, okay.
So...
Can I make
let's wait for that.
Okay.
May I make just one comment? Because, I think we should get more into this when we have the fiscal on Wednesday or Thursday, but the line of questioning from Representative Maurer about the private product, I think that's it's worth asking. I would worry about the continuity of care for these youth aging out, making sure they're staying with the same providers, and I don't know if we could guarantee, particularly around mental health services. I know that's a very difficult disruption to go from a different provider once you hit 18. So that would be a benefit, I think, of keeping them within the health plan.
No,
It just made me want to point that out. That's all.
Do you want to propose an amendment to us?
Well, we could wait until we have the fiscal. I just want to make sure people saw that. Yeah.
Okay, you don't want to put it in now?
You don't want to adopt it.
Okay.
Do we need to adopt it to get the fiscal?
It doesn't hurt, but, you know, whatever the committee wants to do.
Okay.
I don't know. This is the first time people have seen this, so we have two more times before we meet. So.
Oh, yeah, we can hold it till Wednesday then. Can we get a fiscal on it without?
I think so, Mr. President.
Okay. Then let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3664. I mean, I'm sorry, close the work session on House Bill 3664 and open a work session on House Bill 3663. Representative Kotek, do you have a motion on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, House Bill 3663, this is optometric physicians. I would move that we move along with this bill. I think it's in good shape, that we move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor to move House Bill 3663 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Maurer?
Mr. Chair, there was an amendment that was offered by Representative Cannon at the request of one of his students, and I'm wondering what happened to that amendment and why that amendment is not considered.
It's not been offered is why it's not considered. But
well, it has been discussed, and normally we would have an opportunity to discuss it before.
Here's Representative Cannon. There was some question about why the dash one amendments weren't offered.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not particularly interested in moving those amendments. I mean, I think that we have a better bill without them.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
If I may? Can I offer these amendments?
Anybody can offer any amendment, I think.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendment to House Bill 3663.
Yeah. I'll close the work session on House Bill 66.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were
3663 and move it over till Wednesday.
Okay.
Are we ready to go to a public hearing? I think we are.
Sorry.
Go to a.
Do anything. Okay.
I'll check with you. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3603 and ask Representative Widener to open it up with. Bring with you wherever you'd like, sir. Is it okay to let you
die?
Yeah, we'll work it ourselves. You need to keep this on, making sure.
Okay.
Get some action there.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
I was going to give Debbie a chance here to.
Okay. I'm going to comment. And we're. I think I can carry over. I
thought it was like a.
Yes, you did. Except that.
Thank you.
You may fire when ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Jim Widener, House District 24. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, want to thank you for your time today. House Bill 3603, simply put, would repeal 1% provider tax enacted during the 2009 session of House Bill 2116. I would like to begin by addressing the reasoning for this bill. As I am sure is the case with many of you, I have received overwhelming concern from constituents about the continual rise in their health care cost. House Bill 2116 simply adds to that burden through direct tax on insurance, the cost of which are passed on directly to the consumers. Despite the good intentions behind House Bill 2116, the resulting rise in health care costs is unfair and will only exacerbate the problem of high cost and limited access to insurance. We are in one of the worst recessions in Oregon history, and increasing cost on business owners and ultimately on families struggling to make ends meet is disastrous. Small businesses may greatly reduce or eliminate their employee insurance benefits, and working families may fall further behind financially as they scramble to afford private insurance. The increased cost of purchasing individual insurance may also hamper entrepreneurship, as it means just one more obstacle and one more cost. Some say that it's just 1%. This amount is not to be scoffed at. 1% may not sound like much, but I would contend that any increase in the cost of insurance is too much, and 1% tax is only part of what we already are dealing with in the rising costs due to increased mandates. House Bill 2116 was estimated to raise $100 million with this tax. That amount of money derived from the pockets of working families will not go unnoticed. I recognize that the tax in House Bill 2116 was designed to be the funding mechanism to provide insurance for Oregon's uninsured children. I agree wholeheartedly with that issue of uninsured children must be addressed to ensure that they have access to health care they need and deserve. However, I cannot endorse the method of House Bill 2116. I believe we can find other options to make insurance more affordable without simultaneously resulting in cost inadequacies. This tax is not the only increase in cost. Just recently, the State Insurance Division granted the following rate increases: 10% for Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Northwest, 16% for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and 23% for HealthNet Health Plans of Oregon. Every time health insurance premiums for a small business rise by 10%, it costs a small company almost the equivalent of one entry-level job. A small business can now pay around $400 a month for each employee receiving individual insurance benefits, and well into thousands of dollars for insurance covering families. Small business health premiums have more than doubled over the last 9 years, cutting into jobs, wages, and profits, all of which, I remind you, lead to income tax payments that are used to fund critical services, including health programs. Everyday businesses are making decisions about how to control cost in general, especially the rising cost of health insurance plans. Businesses are moving to plans with fewer benefits or ones with higher deductibles, and unfortunately, many are simply dropping coverage for their employees altogether. And for those families who purchase insurance on their own, this tax arbitrarily raises the cost of their health coverage. Making insurance more expensive only makes the viability of purchasing it independently that much more unlikely. If costs become prohibitive, we run the risk of seeing even more people join the ranks of Oregon's uninsured. House Bill 3603 is not about throwing children off of care, and it's not about protecting the pocketbooks of big business. It's about avoiding the hypocrisy that comes when lawmakers talk about wanting to take action to control the rising cost of health care while passing taxes that do not do the exact opposite. I believe we can find solutions to care for Oregon's most vulnerable. I just do not believe we need to increase the cost of health insurance to do so.
Thank you. No questions, so we both hear from both the witnesses. Yes, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Pastore, and I am an independent licensed health insurance agent working out of the McMinnville area. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before you on behalf of the business clients I have the privilege to advise. The thoughts and information I'm about to share with you came directly from these clients. Their experiences are very real, and they affect their lives every day. These clients own or run a business in Oregon and care greatly about their employees and the health coverage they are able to offer. These clients are continuing to receive large increases on their employee health insurance premiums at renewal. Then the state added a 1% increase to their double-digit increases. It put a strain on the goal of insuring their employees. These continuing tax increases are causing small to medium-sized businesses to drop their group health insurance and or lay off their employees. Both choices, in turn, affect private health insurance rate increases due to fewer insured lives. CFO Melinda Lee of Temp Control Mechanical Services, whom employs over 55 people, shared with me, in a year when we are hit with so many obstacles, then having the state tack on an additional tax was yet another hurdle for us to navigate. We have made every effort at TCMS to cut our costs and help to keep our layoffs to a minimum. But letting some long-time employees go is a decision we had to make in order to ensure our competitiveness in our new economy. As we recover and look at adding positions back to our corporate structure, this added tax means that we are looking at an additional cost to do so. In these uncertain times, I feel like the state of Oregon is creating barriers to its unemployment problems, rather than working to help employers get individuals back to work. The financial commitment we make to each employee bringing on is something we take very seriously, and we will weigh it in caution as we move forward. A second information that I received, President Greg Adams of Forest Grove Lumber in McMinnville, whom employs over 40 people, shares, "This tax definitely affects us. Unfortunately, the liberal front now has a foothold, and they will continue to push for more taxes." In regard to the exempt businesses in House Bill 2116, he states, "They are not paying their fair share. The left thinks that we should have equality in many things, which I mostly agree. However, when it comes to money, they pick on the minority that is already paying 30%+ of the bill. Is it really so bad that we are unable to cut programs? Then why pick on the minority? Can't we all pay? We all benefit. We should all pay." And thirdly, owner Lance Dowdle of Excel Orthodontics, who employs over 20 people, shares, "First of all, I do enjoy that there are so many who say that tax is only money. But those nickels and dimes soon add up to be dollars and cents. This year alone, he was audited by the county for property tax. The FDA has also decided that his industry needs more new regulations, and now Measure 66 and 67 will pillage more money out of his account. The substantial increase in his utility bills and a 1% increase on health care costs to provide insurance to the uninsured. And the list can go on and on. Overall, I'm looking to have at least 40 to 60% in additional expenses imposed on me by the government and its agencies this year. Through all of this, he's now working harder than he has ever worked in 20 years of business, and has not even taken a cost of living increase for himself in years. And he will continue to do this to avoid laying off any employees. As an independent licensed health insurance agent, with my clients in these situations, I'm left with the task of advising them on their group benefits with limited choices for solutions. Due to increase after increase, these clients are having to offer decreased health benefits and are requiring more cost sharing from their employees. These cost shares cause participation problems for the group, which force these businesses to drop their health care altogether. Like I discussed previously, these forced choices in turn affect private health insurance rate increases due to fewer insured lives. Bottom line is we need to lower the cost of health care to lower our costs. While I agree that the uninsured should have access to insurance, I struggle to agree with the taxing of the select businesses to make this happen. We all benefit. We should all pay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions of the witnesses?
Actually, Mr. Chair, also submitted was testimony from Rick Rebel. Rick Rebel is a licensed employee benefit consultant with Western States Benefit Planning in Albany, Oregon. Rick Rebel has been an active health care reform in Oregon since 1987 and currently serves on the state's Health Insurance Reform Advisory Board. He also has worked closely with union members in collective bargaining plans with OPEU, AFL-CIO, AFSCME, and IAAF to help seek cost-effective employee benefit solutions. He also has extensive experience as a member of the National Healthcare Underwriters as well. And his written testimony came to you in an email that he had sent to us and everything, and the first paragraph sums up pretty well the feeling of a lot of the insurers and one of the things they ran into. Kelly actually works for the same company, and she came here on his behalf today.
Great, and we'll acknowledge that for the record. I guess, could I ask you a question?
Sure.
Representative Widener's testimony points out that Kaiser has a 10% rate increase, Regions Blue Cross is 16%, and Health Net 23%. How did your customers like those?
Representative Greenlick, they are not happy with those increases.
What about if they had each only been 1%? the part we'll take responsibility for. Suppose they had just been 1%. How would they have thought about them then?
Well, I guess I have to, Representative Greenlick, excuse me. I guess I have to ask, when I shop the insurance for my employee or my businesses, I shop with all the carriers. So they're not only looking at their current and their renewal rates, they're also looking at the other competitive rates. So if they're all 1%, mm-hmm. that would be a different answer based on if they were higher than that.
That's what I'm asking. What if they're all 1%? Since the tax was 1%, what if everything was 1%? Would they be howling in anger over a 1% rate increase?
If that was the only, Representative Greenlick, if that was the...
Please, you can answer.
I'm sorry. If that was the only increase, I guess my answer would be that they wouldn't be screaming. But that's not the case.
No, but you're dealing with a 24% rate increase. If that was 23, they'd be howling exactly the same way. Because that's unreasonable. And let me ask this question. The estimates are that more than 10% of the health insurance costs are health care for the uninsured, the cross shift, right, from the uninsured to the insured. And these funds tend to put more people into the insurance pool, which the estimates are it could reduce, rather than adding 1%, ultimately it could reduce those rates by 2 or 3%. Would they think that would be useful to have happen if we can actually do that?
So your question is if we could put the uninsured into the pool. I believe that the rates decrease based on young and the healthy. The young and the healthy, which are the ones that are opting out of insurance because of affordability, are the ones that are going to decrease our rates.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Welcome to the House Health Care Committee, Representative. I have to say, I just have a question for you. So your very end of your statement, you say House Bill 3603 is not about throwing children off of care. I have to ask you, though, it would. If we did away with the 1% premium tax, we would not be able to be meeting the goals of healthy kids. Do you serve on Ways and Means? Do you have an idea of where we would find that money?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, I do not serve on Ways and Means. One of the things that we ran into in our town hall meetings from time and time again is people wanting to see us reduce health care costs. They don't want to see us raise health care costs. So the issue we're dealing with here is finding ways to do this. When we raise health care costs, we're taking more people out. So we're attacking the middle class because they're the ones who are getting their health care costs cut. One of the things that we did in 2116, and it's stated here in Mr. Rebel's opening paragraph, is a lot of people are upset and a lot of businesses are looking to go to self-insured to avoid this 1%. We excluded people that were self-insured when we passed this bill. It wasn't a tax on everybody. It was a tax on a select few, and it was small and medium-sized business that was left to pick up the bill. This is something we've seen that people are upset about, and we should have addressed it and covered everybody in this 1% tax if we were going to do it.
We may get to that in the next session. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, we did have a lot of debate in this committee about how we were going to do the tax, and you raised some very good points. We also know that by having more people insured, we will get at the overall cost of health care. But again, removing this tax, where are we finding the money? Are you suggesting that there's some money somewhere that will continue to provide the resources for healthy kids? Because I don't think there is. And so I think it's, I don't want to be unfair, but I do think it's to say that this is not about discontinuing the care for children if we got rid of the 1% taxes. I just can't agree with that statement.
Well, no, I guess it is the question. I mean, the question is, you're willing not to enroll those 80,000 kids in health insurance? I guess that's the key question.
If that's the way you want to pose it, I mean, there's different ways that we could address this issue, but you also have to look at, is it something that the state of Oregon, can they afford to do this at this time?
Well, Yeah, if there are other ways to enroll those kids, I'd be happy to hear the suggestion. But if not, the question really is, are you willing to do away with that 1% tax and not enroll 80,000 kids that don't have health insurance? Is that an option you're willing to accept?
With not sitting on your committee and knowing everything that transpired, I cannot give you a clear answer on that at this time, Chair Greenlee.
Well, if we told you that reducing the 1%, eliminating this tax, would not allow us to enroll those kids in health insurance, is that an option you would be willing to accept? I think that's the key we're facing. We eliminate the 1%, then we find some other way to finance the health insurance of those kids, or we leave them uninsured. And if you don't have another option for doing it, is it okay with you if we simply don't provide health insurance for those needy kids?
At this point, you know, I would have to sit back and look.
Thank you. Representative Thompson?
This is a general question. I'm not asking you. Anybody, can you refresh my memory on why we left the self-insured and union trust funds out of this bill?
Seems
like a larger pool.
It is a larger pool, but there were two issues that were unclear at the time, and we needed clarity. One issue was we weren't sure whether that would stand an ERISA challenge, and we were pretty sure that it would be challenged in court.
Yeah.
And the other was that at the time we weren't sure whether or not it could be matched with Medicaid dollars. So it was the uncertainty that pushed us into, I think we all agreed it would be better.
I recall that now, yeah.
It'd be better to spread it. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, Representative, there was no discussion in this committee about 2116, the 1% premium tax. It was, this is it, you vote on it, or you don't. And so the conversation about how we were going to, you know, what was going to be taxed, who was a behind the closed doors conversation. That
we had extraordinary testimony in this committee about that.
On 1%?
Yeah, about not only the 1%, about spreading it wider. Yeah. The hospitals, the insurance companies were here. We had the unions testify.
Well,
we had hours of testimony on it.
I think we had hours of testimony about why this was going to
we
be
had,
a good
on
thing.
On 2009.
No, but on 2116, we talked about why covering kids was a good thing to do and what it would be policy-wise.
I totally agree. So we have young families that are now losing their health insurance because you can't tell me which 1% was the straw that breaks the camel's back that says this small business is not going to provide health insurance anymore. So which family is more deserving?
It stretches credibility to believe that if you get a 24% rate increase, you'll stop insurance, but if it was only 23%, you would keep it. That just stretches credibility.
I am telling you, sir.
Nobody believes that.
You know what? The issue is not about 1% premium tax. It's about the cost of health care, and we have not done anything about the cost of health care. What we've done is we've taxed people to try to reduce it. And the argument was, let's raise the cost of health care so we can try to reduce the cost of health care by 2 to 3%. That's some ethereal, far-out position that we don't know that's going to come true. In fact, it hasn't come true because our rates went up 16 to 24%.
Well, this has nothing to do with the cost of health care. It has to do with the cost of health insurance. And the cost of health insurance is driven by a set of factors.
Right, primarily driven by what we provide.
And by the cost shift to the uninsured, and by the return rates for health insurance companies on their portfolio. All those factors fit into the price of health insurance. And the 1% is a tiny factor in that.
And so it doesn't cost a single dime for government to administer the program. It's all free. I don't buy it for a second.
What's all free?
Somehow that the insurance company is making a profit is, I mean, they state the profit. They present it to the insurance division. They say, this is what we're making. Last year, they hardly made anything. It is an ebb and a flow. And we've had suggestions that government can do it better. And I just don't buy this argument.
Are we talking about socialized medicine here, or are we talking about health insurance rates that are regulated? I mean, You don't want to do it better. Isn't what this issue is about. This issue is a very simple issue. It's a very simple bill. This bill stops the 1% tax. So this is only about, do we not provide health insurance for 80,000 kids, or do we provide health insurance for 80,000 kids? That's all this bill is about. Yeah. It isn't about all these ephemeral other issues.
Well, you know I'm gonna shift the argument just a little bit, if you don't mind.
All right. Unless you want to get in.
Well, just
unless you want to get into this discussion.
Against my better judgment, I probably shouldn't, but I do have one statement I would like to make, Chair Greenlick. Because in Rick's statement here, at the very bottom, he says, in fact, a few of my clients are exploring self-funding as those plans go along. What are you going to do when these companies start self-funding and now you've lost that revenue? You're just going to kick the kids off of health care? Because that's what you're setting yourself up for.
In fact, it's my hope, and this was the promise we made to people, that when we come back for the 2011 session and begin looking at the plans coming out of the health policy board, that we will explore, after having dealt with that uncertainty, the notion of expanding this across all those elements of health insurance. I really believe it should be. I agree with that. And I hope that we'll take a very serious shot at that in the next session, because I think it is fair. Absolutely. I don't have a problem with that.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that, you know, all of our revenue streams here in the state, nothing is certain. We see that in any one of our revenue streams. So I have a hard time saying that, well, because we might have this change, we shouldn't do something that we know will save us money over time, be better for kids and their families, really sound public policy. I don't think anyone on this committee thought it was bad public policy to do this. We can discuss whether or not we thought the funding mechanism was appropriate. But I think to say, well, we shouldn't try things because we're not sure that there might be some blip in the revenue down the line, we deal with that all the time. And I think that's just the reality of how things get budgeted and things get dealt with. But one of the things I wanted to say was on the email from Mr. Rebel, you have a comment that's number two that says, John and Karen Gabriel, who own a company called LC Geospatial in Corvallis with 14 employees on their plan, quote, they're willing to pay a 1% insurance tax so that uninsured people in Oregon have coverage. We feel that it will save money overall, as these people will be more likely to get maintenance care and are therefore less likely to end up in the emergency room. That was the public policy discussion for us. Not only was it a good thing to do, but it will save money over time. So I just wanted to make sure we didn't miss that.
If I may follow up on that, because I know John personally, and he would also say that it's unfair that people were excluded from that tax.
And that's a policy discussion I think we have to continue to have. That, yeah. Again, your bill says without this tax, there's no money for what we're trying to do. So I, you know.
Actually, the proposal, which was an interesting one, was to have a 1.5% tax across all health insurance and self-funded plans. That was a proposal that was put before us. We ended up with a 1% tax on insurance, which, I mean, is a big difference.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And I was just going to say, for final comment, that I think it's the exclusion that really upsets people outside the building. And I think the people outside of this building and this chamber from the healthcare town halls that I have had would really like to see us start reducing the cost of healthcare insurance more so than anything else.
Well, would they have been happier for that proposal with a 1.5% tax across all of them? Would that have made them happier?
I would have to have a town hall on that and get back to you, Chair Greenlick.
I have a feeling it might not have made them happier. But we will take that up again. Ms. Pistori, thank you very much for coming. Is this your first time testifying here?
Could you
talk? Did great. No, you did great.
It's usually not this heated.
That's okay. This one strikes a nerve.
Can we call...
You know, his shins are black and blue right now.
From both sides. And if my wife was here, it would be from all three sides. Dr. Goldberg, Ms. Kaufman, can you join us? And
we have to.
Tell us what that money's doing.
Sure.
Chair Greenlight, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Department of Human Services and the new Oregon Health Authority.
And I've been asked to provide some just background information as to where we are in the implementation of 2116 and what would the effects be if of House Bill 3603 to get at, I think, some of the questions that were just raised. I think, as everybody here knows, we for far too long have had too many kids in this state who have gone without health insurance and health coverage, over 100,000 children. And that meant they didn't get care when they needed it. It meant that their parents worried about how to pay for care, that families went into bankruptcy to pay for care, and that far too often many children received expensive care in the emergency room when they could have gotten care more cost-effectively in a primary care office. The legislature passed House Bill 2116, which created the Healthy Kids Plan. And let me tell you where we are today in implementing that. A couple of pieces. What the Healthy Kids Plan does is two things. It provides the funding so that we can cover all children below 200% of poverty in the Oregon Health Plan, state's Medicaid program. And likewise, we are able to establish a subsidized private insurance product for families above 200% of poverty. That's the Kids Connect program. That just went into effect last month. We signed contracts with five different carriers around the state. There's a statewide option as well as regional options, and families will be able to purchase health insurance at a subsidized level. To date, we've enrolled 31,000 kids in the Healthy Kids Plan. And we hope now with the onset of the new Kids Connect program, as well as the work we've been doing with local community groups in terms of outreach and enrollment assistance, that we will reach the approximately 80,000 children goal that was set out before us. We're right now ahead of schedule, and we'll see if we can keep up with that. We've launched a marketing campaign to make families aware. We've tried to give them application assistance to help families navigate through the system. With that as a background, just briefly, House Bill 3603, as you've just heard, would repeal the 1% premium tax on commercial insurers that provides the funds to be able to cover the approximately 80,000 kids that we hope to enroll over the year. So the impact of this would be one of two things. That first off, we would lose the revenue for this coverage. So that would mean that we would need either $61 million this biennium, and that would roll up to approximately $82 million next biennium to continue to maintain the program. So there would be one of two options. One would be, if this funding went away, would be to find some other funding source for the $61 million this biennium. Or there could be another option, which would be to pass legislation to remove some of the coverage mandates within the bill to decrease the number of children that we as a department were mandated to cover. So those would be the two options ahead of you. The only last two points I would make, and then happy to open it up for questions, would be one issue I think to always take into consideration is the insecurity and instability that sometimes happens within our public process for making public policy. That we last session passed this program. I think there are a number of families that are looking to the future to have a program like this cover them. And certainly discussions about do we or don't we that continue create a variety of instability, which often makes it, I think, very difficult. And then the last point I would make would be actually to piggyback on the good representative's testimony. And I think he made a very important point, which was that indeed, one of the most vexing issues today in our whole healthcare debate is affordability. And certainly that's something that we've got to tackle. it's certainly something that the health authority is going to pursue relentlessly. Making healthcare more affordable for people in this state is a public policy that we've all got to make happen. I believe that this plan is a step in that direction. 10% of all of our costs of healthcare are to cover the costs of the uninsured. And so by bringing more people into coverage, by particularly leveraging what is now 70 cents on the dollar from the federal government to help pay for that, as well as being certain that people get health care at the most cost-effective place, not in an emergency room or in a hospital, will in the long term help us moderate costs. And indeed, that was one of the premises of the Oregon Health Fund Board report. There is not going to be a single solution in this state to lowering health care costs. It's going to take a variety of steps, and certainly one of those steps is being able to bring more of the uninsured into coverage so that we can pay for that in a more rational way. So with that, let me stop and open up for any questions.
Kathy, do you want to comment? I correct the mistakes your boss made.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Kaufman. I'm the manager of the Office of Healthy Kids, and no, I would simply agree with everything.
Wise woman.
Well, except I too have Bruce Shins under the table.
Right. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So how many, the low-cost option became available January 1st. Not the low cost, the full, actually low cost, full cost. Full. Yeah. And I'm on the website, and I've searched the website. I can't find any information about how much it costs. I mean, you know, now it becomes a purchasing decision. You know, when you just give it to me, you know, I don't need a website. Yeah. Just sign me up. But when I'm writing a check, all of a sudden I become really interested in what I'm getting, you know, bang for my buck. So I'm really interested. And then how many people have enrolled for the full cost plan?
Kathy, would you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Kaufman. I'm the manager of the Office of Healthy Kids.
Oh, you did.
Yeah.
I don't mind doing it again.
She did.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer. Yes. We need to get the rate information up ASAP, and we are in the process of doing that. The contracts with all five of the carriers participating in Kids Connect are signed as of today. Until all of those contracts were signed, we weren't able to share the detailed rate information. We could only talk in generalities and averages. Fortunately, we can now get that information out to families.
So that that was released today at 8?
It was over 300.
At 8 a.m.?
The contract.
And the website's not up, and it's
4:30.
But answer your question. What about the between 200 and 300? If I'm a family enrolling in that, do I know what that cost is?
I will cut you some slack.
Okay. So, Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, we will have those rates up. The other part of your question was how many families do we have who are now enrolling in Kids Connect. We did begin processing applications for families above 200% beginning January 1st. I believe we have just over 100 families who have been determined to be eligible for Kids Connect and have been transferred over to OPHP to begin the enrollment selection and process. So those families should get enrolled fairly quickly, and we hope to have many more enrolled by month's end. I will be happy to share with the committee our detailed rate information.
So most of the 30,000 are below 200%?
Correct.
Chair Greenlee, yeah, all of the 31,000 are below. We won't see data for Kids Connect enrollees until March.
Yeah, I'm very interested in it. I mean, $280 a month for the full cost plan. You know, I can go to Regents and get a plan for a whole lot less than that. Now, I've got a deductible, and I don't know what those...
It won't be the complete coverage. Is that the difference? Is that this coverage is very broad coverage?
Very broad subscription.
Same basis.
Very, Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, it's very comprehensive coverage, and I think that's also part of the value equation. This includes mental health, It also includes dental and, you know, full prescription coverage. So those are some of the decisions and guaranteed issues. So those are some of the decisions that were made in putting this together from a policy perspective, was to offer a comprehensive option for families.
Dr. Obler, you gave some estimates of what the 200 to 300% would cost families. Could you share that with us?
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, as Kathy indicated, we've just signed the contracts. So just to give you a sense of what some of the premium and affordability is for families that have one child and are between 200 and 250% of poverty, they have a choice of plans depending on where they live, but their cost will be somewhere between $18 and $28 a month, depending on where they live in the state and the plan that they choose. Likewise, if they're between 250 and 300% of poverty, it will be somewhere between $28 and $42 a month. For families with 2 to 4 children, if they're between 200 and 250% of poverty, it will be somewhere between $31 and $49 to cover all those 2 to 4 children, in essence, a family rate. And for those 250 to 300%, it will be somewhere between about $47 and $70 approximately.
And those rates are low because of the federal match that goes with it?
And correct. Chair Green, like members of the committee, that's because there's a 90% subsidy between 200 and 250% of poverty that's made up of a combination of the vast majority being federal funds, and a piece of that is from the premium tax. And between 250 and 300%, it's an 85% subsidy. And what we have tried to do is keep cost sharing. And the federal government has actually mandated that cost sharing will be kept at below 5% of families' gross income. And that's a combination of both the premium as well as any out-of-pocket expenditures that families have. So we've been asked and to make this affordable by keeping the totality of cost sharing below 5% of the family's income. And the premium piece is just one piece of that.
And when you send out the rate information on the over 300, which I think this is very interesting information.
Yes, and Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I think one of the things that we've struggled with in putting together this plan has been above 300% to try and, you know, balance out both affordability and comprehensive coverage for that group. And I think one of the things that we're going to be going back and taking a look at over the next couple of months, now that we've got this up and going, is are there some creative ways we can look at to try and make this more affordable to families that don't have a subsidy?
Go ahead. Representative Mauer, go ahead.
No, Representative Nathanson.
Representative Nathanson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have something to ask Dr. Goldberg, and I'm kind of sorry that Representative Widener, and I think her name is Ms. Pastore, I don't think they're still in the room. It speaks to their testimony as well. Dr. Goldberg, you mentioned moderating the costs. You talked about avoiding more expensive care at hospitals. We know the benefit of prevention, early detection, treatment, and so forth. The thing where sometimes we don't connect the dots is people are outraged at how much more their own health insurance policy is costing. In testimony a little while ago, we heard a recent rate increase is 10% for Kaiser, 16% for Regents, 23% for Health Net. Those are really big numbers. Because what we're trying to do is bend the curve, and part of the way you do that is to ensure more people so they're getting appropriate treatment at the right time, do you think, from knowing what you know about not only the cost of health care, but the cost of health insurance, do you think that by doing this, if we did not do this, let me put it that way, if we weren't covering more people, and if we weren't able to insure this many more kids, is it possible that these rates that we've seen, 10%, 16% increase, 23%, could be even higher in future years?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Nathanson, certainly what we do know is that 10% of the cost of our, what we pay, of what the insured pay for health care, is paying for the uninsured. And indeed, if we continue to have more and more uninsured, and those costs are passed on to somebody, and that will indeed add to the cost of care. At some point, I do believe that we have to look at how we create a solution, you know, across all of us to be able to bear both the cost and the responsibility.
Mr. Chair, a brief
please
comment in response. That's my conclusion as well. It's helpful to have you explain your conclusion from this. I think what it tells me is we may be alarmed, upset, angry about seeing a 16% increase, a 23% increase. What we're not saying is it can be even more than that. We're trying to bend the curve so that those rate increases are smaller over time, not larger.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Nathanson, the other thing that I would just add to the equation, although it's really difficult to calculate the expenses, is there are certainly costs elsewhere that are borne by us, whether that's within our schools for kids who don't have their mental health care needs met. There are costs throughout the system that occur because we're unable to take care of things on the front end. And so it's not just health insurance costs. It's a lot of the other costs further along because we don't address issues up front.
And in someone else's budget.
Correct.
But it's a cost nonetheless.
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Mao, and then Representative Parker.
Go ahead. Is there any research on ER utilization between uninsured people and Medicaid population? It's a loaded question because there is.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Mao.
You have a comment.
I was going to, my answer was yes, but don't ask me what the difference is. I can't tell you that offhand.
I mean, I don't have the studies here.
But we can get that for you.
I believe that the Medicaid population, in fact, uses the ER more than the uninsured population. Because the uninsured population tends to wait until they're sicker to show up to the ER because they think they're going to have a bed. I also, you know, this issue of preventive care isn't always cheaper. And, you know, if it's always about the dollar, then I think we're probably going to never figure it out. It's about quality of life. That's a completely different conversation.
But the main difference is when a Medicaid patient uses the emergency room and is hospitalized for it, it's covered by health insurance. It's not cost-shifted to something else. When an uninsured person uses the ER and is hospitalized, that money doesn't change the cost of medical care. It changes the cost of health insurance because those costs are cost-shifted.
Because Medicaid isn't public money? It doesn't come from a tax bill someplace?
No. It's talking about the price. The price of private health insurance is not... There is not a cost shift directly from Medicaid to the price of private health insurance, but there is a direct cost shift when the uninsured use the emergency room in the hospital. That is cost shifted to people that have health insurance. That's the issue. The issue, and that's why I was saying before, the issue isn't about the cost of health care. It's about the price of health insurance. And I don't think any of this changes the cost curve. It changes the health insurance premium. That's...
Yeah, but the premium is driven by the cost of the care.
By the cost of the care of the insured and by the cost shift from the uninsured to the insured when they use hospitals and emergency rooms. It's those two components. It's 90%, well, it's about 80% utilization, about 10% administration, and about 10% the cost shift.
Okay.
And 1% the tax.
That's a new one.
I forgot that one.
We just invented that one.
Yes, we did.
No answer.
Representative Harker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So as follow-up to that conversation, which you haven't quite resolved yet, and I don't think you're going to, I have a business, and I have told myself, like the second respondent in the letter that you read there, that I feel good about this particular 1% because it's my hope that we are going to bring the cost down. Now, rightly or wrongly, when are we going to know? When are we going to, how up to date are we on the data that we collect at ERs and elsewhere so that I can look forward or I can gauge when I will hear some numbers similar to you're able to tell me now that we've got 31,000 folks are coming in and we've got this much progress being made. We're actually ahead of schedule, I think you said, in terms of enrollment of these kids. When will we get some feedback that tells us if we're right, if we're wrong on our projection that this 1% tax is actually going to help us bring down folks going to the ER, elsewhere, associated costs?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Harker, members of the committee, I think it's going to be a couple of years until we can really provide some reasonable data as to the effects. Part of what we need is a robust database for the state to be able to do that. I think that's what you're getting at is part of the what was a larger package of how we can look at making healthcare more affordable in this state. So part of that is having an all-payer, all-claims database, being able to better understand some of the costs and where some of the dollars go. I think we're going to need to get to a place where we have sufficient enrollment in this program to be able to provide some of that information. There is an evaluation component built in, but it's going to, I believe, take some time before we can provide the kind of reliable information that would, I think, satisfy you.
Yeah, and we may never know because the dynamic is so complicated. Mm-hmm. The problem is that there are some, we are likely to find even more uninsured people even as we move people into this. And we've been able to look at the uncompensated care because we passed a bill that makes that metric a little easier to see. But my guess is uncompensated care will go up even as we add people to Medicaid because the economic conditions is really driving more people to be uninsured, I'm afraid. There's going to be some measure. But it's going
2 weeks ago, there was an article in our local paper. It was about ER utilization in our hospital because it's been really high, Three Rivers Community Hospital. I expected that ER utilization would have increased last year because of the economy, uninsured people. In fact, that did not pan out. ER utilization dropped. So, I don't know.
It is. I mean, people are using other methods.
I don't know what happened, mm-hmm. but I just thought I was really stunned by that number. That in fact, the utilization dropped at that hospital, and it's extremely highly utilized.
I think Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, ER utilization is tied to a lot of different things. It's not just economy; it's about the availability of primary care access that's convenient for individuals. It's about, I think, a variety of factors that drive ER utilization. My guess is that it's multifactorial and we're not going to find the single point, whether it be economy, primary care, et cetera, that drive it.
Well, there are fewer primary care docs in Oregon or in Grants Pass last year than there were the year before. So you would expect then that number would go up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair,
yes.
Sorry,
I'm sorry, Kathy. Go ahead, please.
If I could just respond in general, I understand we want to see real cost savings for all of the efforts that the health authority undertakes, and I expect that we will see that, but I think we need to bear in mind that the cost savings Healthy Kids will generate will be ones we see over the lifetimes of the children that we enroll. We know that kids without health care coverage are more likely to miss school, more likely to have illnesses that go untreated and compel them to seek care in emergency rooms, which is not just about raising the cost of the health care system as a whole, although that certainly matters. It's also about the health and well-being of the future of our state. So that's as much a compelling economic reason as any.
Other questions? Thank you both very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3603 and carry it over for a possible work session Wednesday on another amendment to it, a gun stuff amendment to it, which we might or might not have on Wednesday. I am not going to carry over Representative Maurer's bill, House Bill 3611, and we are both committed to. Did Bruce go?
Yeah, he.
Yeah, he won't.
Okay. Well, we'll. We are committed. No, he doesn't have to. We'll figure it out. We are committed to work that in the interim, and that means we're going to have some help from
smart people,
from LFO and LRO and the Office of Health Policy and Research and some other places. We really do want to try and find out how to deal with the dynamic of if we provide deductibility for individual purchases of health insurance, how we can arrange other deductibility so we can come up with maybe a wash on that. Mm-hmm. And it seems important to do that for a variety of issues, but fairness isn't the least of those, it seems to me.
Well, we can't get to the policy conversation until we have the data, mm-hmm. or yeah. even pretend data. Right now we're doing even pretend data.
Okay. Before I go, I think I've announced everything that we are planning to carry over, but if you guys will follow with me and make sure there isn't anything I've missed, I think we're going to carry over for only work sessions HB 3639, 3662, 3663, 3664, 3667, and 3603. I think, did we start with 9 bills?
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
And pass two.
And six. We're not carrying over one.
Right.
So that means six carry over.
Correct.
I think we're going to finish our work by Thursday. I'd ask you to possibly be prepared to stay over an hour on Thursday. You still might want to keep that as a possibility, but I don't think we'll need it. I think we'll be doing fine with our House bills.
I agree.
Is there anything else to be brought before the committee? We are adjourned. Let the record know 35 minutes early.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.